An iBank's function extends beyond just simple storage. It includes a complex system involving specialized infrastructures and a trained workforce able to handle delicate tissues with care and speed.
Welcome to iCan, a podcast about ophthalmology through a uniquely Canadian lens with Dr. Mona Dagher and myself, Dr. Hadi Saheb.
Bienvenue à iCan, un balado sur l'ophtalmologie sous un angle typiquement canadien avec le Dr. Hadi Saheb et moi-même, Dr. Mona Dagher.
Season 4 of the iCan podcast is brought to you by Bayer Ophthalmology. We thank them for their support. Nous aimerions remercier Bayer Ophthalmology pour leur support de la quatrième saison du balado iCan.
We will share our experiences as ophthalmologists today and tackle some of the challenges we face as healthcare providers. Hey there, eye care enthusiasts. It's Mona and
Hadi, back at it again with iCan.
You know it, Hadi. Today's episode is going to be a real eye-opener. Pun intended.
Mona, always with the puns. I promise, folks, today's discussion will be just as sharp as Mona's great wit.
Hey, we're here to keep it both informative and entertaining, right?
Absolutely. So whether you're a seasoned ophthalmologist or just as fascinated by eyes as we are, you're in for a treat.
On this episode of iCan, we discuss an important topic related to equity, diversity, and inclusion in ophthalmology, specifically barriers to corneal donation. And we have Dr. Samir Jabour, a cornea disease specialist in Montreal, as our guest. Dr. Jabour practices at the Centre Hospitalier de l'Université de Montréal and the Jewish General Hospital and serves as an assistant clinical professor at the University of Montreal and an adjunct clinical professor at McGill University. His specialties include corneal disorders, external eye diseases, and refractive surgery, with a particular expertise in corneal grafts, limbal stem cell transplants, keratoconus, and complex cataracts. His academic journey started at the Faculty of Medicine at McGill University for medical school. He then completed his ophthalmology residency at the University of Montreal. Subsequently, he undertook 2 years of subspecialty training in cornea, external disease, and refractive surgery at the renowned Wilmer Eye Institute at the Johns Hopkins School of Medicine in Baltimore, Maryland. And then a second prestigious fellowship at Moorfields Eye Hospital in London, United Kingdom. He is currently pursuing a master's in public health at Harvard University.
Dr. Jabour's research primarily focuses on ocular surface disease, keratoconus, and surgical techniques in keratoplasty, cataract, and refractive surgery. His contributions to the field grace the pages of top-tier medical journals. He frequently presents his work at national and international conferences. And as the director of the Cornea Fellowship at the SHUM, he mentors upcoming cornea specialists. Additionally, he teaches medical students and ophthalmology residents from Université de Montréal and McGill. Sam, thank you for joining us and welcome to iCan.
Thanks, Mona. Thanks, Hadi, for having me.
Let's delve into the topic, Sam. Corneal transplantation is a life-changing procedure for many people with vision impairments. But unfortunately, there's a significant scarcity of corneas for those who really need it. Can you tell us if there's really a current shortage of corneas? And if so, what are the primary reasons behind this?
Absolutely. So the short answer is yes, there is currently a shortage of corneal transplantation in the world. We know that corneal blindness is one of the leading causes of reversible blindness worldwide. We estimate today that 12.7 million people are waiting for a transplant in the world. And there's currently one cornea for every 70 patients waiting. Around half of the population lacks access to corneal transplantations. So yes, worldwide, there's a very deep shortage of corneas for transplantation and for many reasons. But before we dwell into the reasons, it's worth noting that when we talk about the shortage of corneal donations for transplantations, we're touching on a nuanced issue. It's not as much a shortage of the tissue itself, because statistically, there are more people who pass away, unfortunately, than those who need a graft. This means that if everyone who passes away were to donate their corneas and systems were in place to retrieve them, store them, there would be actually a surplus of tissue for everyone in need. So the issue is not really an issue of corneal tissue shortage, but more mainly an issue of tissue availability. And the real bottleneck is a triad of factors. Number one would be donation awareness or donation hesitancy. Number two would be eye banking infrastructure capacity. And number three would be usage capacity. Let's start talking about the donation awareness issue. So why would an individual not want to donate their corneas? Most people simply don't realize that they can donate their corneas. I stumbled upon a study on a survey of Canadians conducted by you, Mona, actually, and your team, that pinpointed that 70% of patients or Canadians have never heard about a corneal transplant. And one third would not be willing to donate simply because they're not even aware of the issue at hand. These numbers are staggering, especially given Canadians' high level of education compared to the rest of the world. So imagine the impact of this lack of awareness in less developed parts of the world. And to add, many individuals might just not be aware of the process of opting for organ donation and tissue donation, or even be willing to do so, especially if it's a cumbersome one. Now, the second reason is the capacity of iBanking infrastructures. An iBank's function extends beyond just simple storage. It includes a complex system involving specialized infrastructures and a trained workforce able to handle delicate tissues with care and speed. The journey of donated corneal tissue is very meticulous. Retrieval must be timely, and the subsequent steps of processing, preserving, and storing are all equally critical. Inter-iBanking networks are also very important here. For most iBanks, it's not an isolated operation, but a collaborative web that networks regions and countries. Our Canadian iBank, for example, have established a network with iBanks in the States to address local shortages when needed. So financing is the bedrock of this entire operation. Robust funding is essential for maintaining and enhancing the infrastructures that supports iBanking. While we in Canada, as well as our peers in the States and Europe, are fortunate to have established sophisticated iBanks, we still even encountered various challenges from financial constraints to logistical issues. And this disparity in infrastructures becomes even more pronounced when we look at developing countries, where the need for corneal tissue is actually often the greatest. Many of these nations lack the facilities altogether, which forces them into a position of dependence on tissue importation, usually from the States, at prices that can be very expensive. And this is why actually so much effort is being put right now to finding alternatives to iBanks, such as the work on artificial corneas or keratoprosthesis, for example, that can be readily available and bypass the system of conventional iBanking. And finally, the last layer of the issue is tissue usage. In North America, for example, we're in a fortunate position with a strong donor base of iBanks in place. However, the issue that often arises isn't a shortage of corneal tissue, but rather the availability of surgeons and operating times. And I think, Mona, you'd agree, as cornea surgeons in Quebec, this is the issue that we usually deal with most of the time. In my personal practice, it's a rare recurrence to cancel a procedure due to lack of corneal tissue. Typically, the wait times, which can extend beyond 6 months, are primarily due to challenges of scheduling surgery rather than tissue shortage. Now, this situation signals that we've made substantial progress in the initial phases of corneal transplant processing, such as donations and iBanking. The focus now shifts towards improving the efficiency of our healthcare delivery. There's a clear need to streamline surgical schedules, potentially increasing the number of qualified corneal surgeons and embracing innovations that can expedite operative care.
Samir, I'd love to unpack some of the possible barriers, and you alluded to a number of them, but I'm wondering if cultural and religious beliefs influence attitudes towards corneal donation in different communities or different regions of the world. So are you able to discuss some of those, some possible misconceptions or myths surrounding corneal donations?
Yes, Hadi, absolutely. They absolutely can, actually, and to a very large extent. We know, for example, that in many cultures and religious contexts, there's a strong hesitation to donate organs or tissues after death. And this is particularly true when it comes to the eyes. The eyes hold a special place in the human psyche, often seen as mirrors of the soul. The saying, "eyes are the window to the soul," isn't just a saying. It shows the profound cultural and personal value ascribed to our eyes. Thus, the decision to actually donate an eye carries an intimate weight that isn't as strongly felt with other organs like the hearts or the lung, for example. Religion can also play a very important role. For example, in Japan, Shinto, the Japanese traditional religion, there's a strong belief that the dead body is impure. So this has led to some resistance towards organ donation. And indeed, Japan has one of the lowest rate of organ donations compared to the rest of the developed world. The resistance can also come from the fear of disfigurement and death, a misconception that persists till today, despite the respectful and careful way in which eye globe are actually retrieved from the dead. This fear can often be dismissed through the education and by highlighting the dignified manner in which donors are actually treated after their death. And also to address these hesitations, I think it's very effective to appeal to the universal virtue of altruism. Emphasizing the ability to give the gift at sight can transform the conversation around eye donation. When we discuss the altruistic act of donation, we're invoking the essence of helping others, which is a principle celebrated across various cultures and faiths. And this is where the role of religious and cultural figures can play a role to shift the conversation.
Can you tell us, Sam, what successful initiatives or campaigns have been implemented to raise awareness about corneal donation and also to overcome these barriers to donation? I think if we understand more of the strategies, we can improve the outreach programs and encourage more people to donate.
Yes, of course. I mean, when it comes to raising awareness about corneal donation, we've really seen some truly innovative initiatives across the globe. So some of these effective strategies are the following. First of all, public educational campaigns. I mean, these are efforts that use a variety of media outlets to dispel myths and share impactful stories of lives that have been changed by corneal transplantation. These can include testimonies from patients or educational videos. And by tapping into the potential of the vast network of social media, we can create ways of awareness that can become actually action. The power of these campaigns is magnified when influencers, for example, or celebrities lend their voices, encouraging widespread support. There's also university and school programs. Educating people at a very young age about the importance of organ donation can foster a culture of donation very early on. And beyond universities, they can take form in cultural and religious centers, as we previously discussed. Observance days can also be a very powerful tool to raise awareness. The most successful example would be in India, for example, where they have an India's National Eye Donation Fortnight, a two-week event every year during which the importance of eye donation is brought to the public, reaching out to communities and clarifying misconceptions through a mix of activities and outreach. And of course, there's also the legislative advocacy, which is all about creating a more donor-friendly environment. By pushing for policy changes that ease the registration process, we can make it easier for individuals to commit to donation. For example, the opt-out system, which presumes consent unless explicitly stated otherwise, has been implemented in some countries like the UK. These legislative reforms can remove obstacles and make donor registration easier. In many regions, including the States, for example, linking donor registration to routine processes such as driver's license renewals has proven to be very effective. And this simple yet effective strategy has the potential to significantly boost the numbers of registered donors. So by bringing together various strategies, including education, legislative reform, public engagement, we can create a strong and supportive framework for corneal donation.
ICANN wants to know what you think. Please send your comments on today's episode or any suggestions you may have for topics or features to communications@cos-sco.ca. And we will try to incorporate them into future episodes.
I'm Dr. Sarah Chorfi, and I listen to the ICANN podcast.
I recently learned that the current guidelines for corneal donation exclude donations from men who have had sex with men within the last 5 years. And that's a significant barrier related to regulatory restrictions. And so I'm wondering if these exclusionary policies are based on outdated information and whether they might be unfairly limiting the potential pool of donors. So can you share your thoughts on that current guideline?
Absolutely, yes. So the topic of NSM, or men who have had sex with men, individuals, and corneal donation, it's actually very interesting. And it's a very sensitive topic that carries both historical, medical, and cultural facets to it. Historically, the deferral of MSM donors was rooted in concern about the HIV transmission at a time during there was an AIDS crisis. And at that time, the HIV testing had a substantial window period, which justified longer deferral times. Now, fast forward today, the landscape of testing has evolved dramatically. With the regular antibody antigen ELISA test, for example, HIV can be detected 35 days after exposures in most cases and up to 12 weeks at max. These tests are today the standard testing in Canada. But with the advent of nucleic acid testing, which we call NATs, the window of detecting HIV has been more reduced to about 1 week after viral exposure. So at 1 week, NAC has essentially a specificity and sensitivity of 100%. NAT is available in Canada, but it's still not the go-to test because the costs associated with it. So we see many countries have actually successfully caught up with the advent of new testing and the risk mitigation through organ donation. So for example, in the UK, there's a three-month deferral period for MSM donors. The European Iobank Association does not enforce a ban on MSM donors, with some differences across member countries. Spain and Italy, for example, have no deferral period, while France and the Netherlands have a four-month deferral period. But today, by far, the biggest outlier is the States, which enforces a five-year deferral period. This law, which was enforced by the US Public Health Services in 1994, is still enforced today by the FDA. At the time of the introduction of the policy, HIV screening tests were unreliable up to 6 months after viral exposure. And to boost, the FDA has actually decreased blood donation restrictions to only 3 months in 2020 and dropped the deferral period for all solid organs. Thankfully, things seem to be improving around, and the deferral period is actually under review in the FDA, by the FDA. And in Canada today, we fare better, but not much better. Our iBanks mandated to comply with the Canadian Standards Association, the CSA, as well as the Safety of Human Cells, Tissues, and Organ Transplantation Regulation. And for that, a 12-month deferral period was established. However, most of our iBanks comply with the iBank Association of America, or the EBAA, to certification, which follows US standards, or a five-year deferral period. So we have this interesting hybrid model in Canada where the national guidelines are set at 12 months deferral period, but most iBanks still follow the five-year deferral period due to certification issues by the States. And it also seems that some Canadian iBanks operate with a hybrid system, maintaining their accreditation, but diverging from practices from the US regulations. I think it's worth noting that there has been at least 10 reported cases in the literature on corneal transplants coming from donors who are HIV positive. None of these 10 corneal recipients from the HIV positive donors contracted HIV, whereas all 12 recipients who received the solid organs all contracted HIV. So we know based on a few cases that even in patients with a high viral load of HIV, it seems that the risk of transmission of HIV through corneal transplant to be relatively low, unlike solid organs. And this is largely due to the fact that the cornea is an avascular structure, so there's no vessels going into it. The cornea does not also seem to be a reservoir of HIV, even in the context of high viral loads, as based on a few pathology studies that I've seen. And now you may wonder, does it actually matter? How many corneas are actually being discarded each year because of this issue? Well, most iBanks do not keep track of these numbers that have been discarded because of this exclusion criteria. A nicely written paper by Dr. Puente from the States who has been instrumental in moving things around in the States, has devised a hybrid estimation, which calculated that in 2018 alone, almost 3,217 corneas were discarded in the States just based on the MSM exclusion criteria. So this is far from being non-significant. And beyond just the numbers, such policies can have a significant cultural and political impact on a community by being a conduit of stigmatization and echo outdated negative stereotypes. It really suggests a form of blanket mistrust of the LGBTQ community, ignoring advancement in testing and responsible behavior of individuals in this group. It creates an us versus them narrative that can alienate many individuals and potential donors with a sense of altruism. Similarly, it can create as many situations of unwillingly outing family members of the deceased by informing them that their kin has been labeled as increased infectious risk and can therefore not donate their organs as he intended to. So there's a lot of issues at play here.
Thanks for sharing that with us. It's very informative. Can you tell us more about this U.S. working group, the Barriers to Corneal Donations group, and elaborate some of the advocacy efforts that you're undertaking or planning to undertake? And what is the goal of this working group?
Absolutely. So within the COS EDI committee, we've established what we call the Advancing Corneal Donation Working Group, with a mandate to collect data and gain a thorough understanding of the current corneal donation practices in Canada, as well as the current evidence on HIV testing and organ donation, with the ultimate goal to craft a policy memo for stakeholders like Health Canada to revise the 12-month deferral period. We're doing this by benchmarking Canadians' practices against those in the States and Europe, surveying our iBanks, and engaging field experts. I would like to note that while I'm taking the lead on this project, really all the credit goes to all the ophthalmologists who have been volunteering in this working group and who have been doing tremendous work. And for that, I would like to recognize their effort and name them as they deserve the same credits, if not more. And these are Dr. Maya Tong, Dr. Sid Nat, Dr. Reem Aziz, Dr. Gukar Khan Saroya, Dr. Liz Kalichik, and of course, Jill Garner from the COS, who has been instrumental in making things move forward. But often is the case with these, with such projects, ours took an exciting turn. Just as we were about to begin to survey Canadian iBanks, we learned that a similar effort was already underway, leading us to join forces with Dr. Murdoch Lees from the University of Manitoba. So Dr. Lees is actually an ER doctor who has been leading a program on health equity and organ donations. He has been doing fantastic work for the past 2 years. So we had actually a joint meeting with him last week, along with Dr. Stephen Brodowski, the chair of the COS iBank Committee, where they shared their valuable insights from their work. So our discussion centered on a critical need to reevaluate and update the criteria for corneal transplantation. We hope that instead of broad community bans, such as on MSM donors, for example, we would like to push for targeted restrictions based on individual behaviors and risk factors, such as IV drug use or unprotected sexual intercourse, for example. Ideally, also, those who qualify as being high risk could still be eligible through donation, for example, through NAT testing, which has a window period of 1 week. And with great anticipation, we're actually preparing our next meeting, which is going to be at the end of the month. And we have invited Dr. Michael Puente, which, as I mentioned, has been instrumental in moving things around in the US, as long with Dr. Lees as well. So it's been a very exciting time and very exciting meetings that we're setting for the future. And we're really excited about what to come. We are learning tremendously along the way. We're collaborating. And with so much enthusiasm and coordinated effort, we feel like maybe, hopefully, we can impact and improve outdated exclusion criteria.
Wow, that sounds amazing. And what a great example of how, the COS bringing like a few motivated, passionate champions towards an important cause can make a difference. So good luck with that. And thanks for doing all of that. As we wrap up, we often like to ask our guests to tell us a little bit more about themselves, some of the things they're doing in outside of their professional life. So can you share anything, incriminating or not incriminating about what you do in your non-work time, Samir?
Sure, absolutely. I mean, I think those who know me intimately know I'm always up to something new, a new project, something's going on. And actually, my close friends would joke around like, what's new with you nowadays? Like, what are you up to these days? And I think this really stems from a sense of like being curious. And I always feel like this need to learn or grow or learn something new. So the short answer is actually interested in a lot of things. I like sports. I like culture. For example, now one of my sports projects is running half a marathon in September. And learning a handstand. So I've been working on this for the past couple of months. Also, I've been like looking more into art history. I want to become better at recognizing artists right away by looking at canvases. So fortunately, I love spending time with my friends, but I also have a lot of time spending time with myself. And I can very easily entertain myself with these small projects.
Sounds amazing. Where are you in your handstand journey?
5 seconds.
5 seconds. That's okay. So you're at handstand. You're not building up to it. You've already got there. And now you're just trying to prolong it. Congrats. Thank you, Samir. Well, that was great. You taught me a ton, and I'm sure you'll teach our listeners a ton. And as a non-cornea specialist, you got me hooked on this topic, and I'm going to look forward to hearing some progress. Interesting, when I was a resident, before I differentiated into a glaucoma specialist, I started something called the McGill Corneal Donation Awareness Campaign. And wow. So touched on a number of the topics that you touched on today. And it was essentially, reaching out to the hospital wards, for a place where a lot of people pass away, sadly, to talk to the nurses about, the importance of corneal donation and to help get their help to increase awareness. And so I kind of dug deep, in the topic and I think you highlighted so many of the issues, and you obviously know more about it than I did at the time. So I realize this is such an important topic for our patients and our communities as well. So thanks for being passionate about it and moving things forward. Thanks for being with us tonight.
Thanks, Sadie. Thanks, Mona.
Thank you, Sammy.
ICANN wants to know what you think. Please send your comments on today's episode or any suggestions you may have for topics or features to communications@cos-sco.ca, and we will try to incorporate them into future episodes. Season 4 of the ICANN podcast is brought to you by Bayer Ophthalmology. We thank them for their support.
Nous aimerions remercier Bayer Ophthalmology pour leur support de la quatrième saison du balado ICANN. Thank you from the Canadian Ophthalmological Society.
ICANN is written and directed by Kim Teitler and produced by John Allaire from Allaire Strategic Works.
ICANN is available on Apple, Spotify, and Google platforms, and of course, through the COS Practice Resource Center.
Some episodes this season will include relevant links and show notes, so be sure to check episode descriptions to learn more.
Thank you for joining us this week. We look forward to bringing you more episodes.